might not eliminate or reduce the risk of disguised personal consumption, which is seem not to be able to make a tax input claim. And so you've got input taxable values of at least 100,000 rand or input tax on 5 million rand worth of expenses or supplies made to the company. That principle goes against the principle of the VAT Act, which says if you are in the VAT system, you're a VAT registered vendor, you can claim back your input tax. It shouldn't be held back for some monetary event. So that we are concerned and our submission speaks to that. Then also we have a problem with the way that it starts at the moment, the delay in getting a person registered, and your recovery of your VAT incurred in that period from when you've made application until your registration is approved, and our submission also makes proposals on that. So one of the things we say that if this proposal goes through and we have the delay of the refund of our inputs, we ask that interest, you know, that interest automatically be paid on the period from when you have to, we're entitled to make an input to tax deduction until you finally make that. The e-commerce suppliers, some of our members are in favour of having it implemented immediately, and some of them say we must caution it and take a bit of time here. What the commissioner essentially wants to introduce here is a place of supply rule. But presently, if I import software or music from overseas, the duty is on me as a final consumer of the product to go and pay over the VAT source. In practice, this doesn't happen. And what the registration of e-commerce is to address it, and we support the fact that it would level the playing field, because currently South African suppliers selling these goods are at a disadvantage. They have to charge 40% of their goods, whereas people importing the goods from overseas, they don't pay that. So but we just think that the definition of e-commerce is very broad, and many non-resident suppliers would be caught by it. We are concerned that we don't exactly know who will have to police and apply that. And we suggest that guidance should be taken from global best practice dealing with business to business or business to consumer suppliers. We deal with that extensively in our submission.
Thank you, please. I'm going to deal with three issues. Share schemes, R&D very briefly, and then the interest changes. Firstly, the share schemes. I'm sure you're all aware that share schemes are basically designed to retain employees. Shares are given to employees, and generally they are also entitled to take them up without some kind of condition for some period of time. They're also designed under the 8B provisions to assist with empowerment for the board-based employee share schemes. Now, there are a number of changes made to the provisions relating to share schemes this year, and they'll set out on, or our comments thereon are set out on pages 10 to 16 of the submission. A number of them are very technical, for example, the fact that Section 8A, the original scheme provision, is being removed, and we are saying that perhaps that should not happen because at the end of the day, there are people still in those schemes, those old schemes. And without that section, then there won't be any regulation or ability to see how they're supposed to be treated. So those are kind of technical things. But what we would prefer to cover is the principle of the fact that the legislation is now stating that where a dividend is paid by a share which is held by an individual under a restriction, that dividend will be allowed as a deduction in the paying company and will be included in the hands of the recipient. Now, if you listen to that, in principle, that sounds fine. But there are a number of problems with the legislation, and we really don't see why SARS is actually messing with this. If one considers that currently what happens is an amount is not deducted in a company, it is paid out as a dividend, and 15% is paid on that dividend when it's paid to an individual as withholding tax. The effective rate of the non-deduction of the dividend tax is 38.8%. If an amount is received by an employee, that employee might be in the highest tax bracket of 40%. So yes, SARS is losing 1.2%. But if one considers this can hit broad-based employee share schemes as well, then the rate can be anything up from basically 18% upwards. So SARS isn't then losing anything. One questions really what they're trying to gain. The specific problems are largely administrative, relating to if an amount is paid out, who withholds the PAYE, is it the company that employs the individual, or is it the company that is paying the dividend, because often when considered particularly listed companies, there is a holding company, there is a subsidiary company, which is the operating company which employs the people. The subsidiary company is deducting employees' remuneration, but it's the holding company that's paying these dividends. Which company can deduct? And that's not fair. In the holding company, there wouldn't be a deduction because all they would be receiving is dividends which are exempt. So there's a problem there. And similarly, when one comes to think about the withholding tax on dividends, often in listed companies, it is straight, it is regulating the withholding taxes. And how will they know which of these employees? There will need to be some kind of mechanism. So there are a number of problems with these provisions, and obviously we would suggest that they don't be made, because we don't really see the point. But if they are to be made, then the specific problems relating to who's deducting what need to be dealt with. The next aspect that I'm going to talk about is research and development, and as I said, I will deal with that very briefly because I know that my colleague from KPMG dealt with it extensively yesterday, and particularly some of the technical issues. But I think the point that I would like to make specifically is that the explanatory memorandum talks about a streamlining of the legislation, and in reality it's a rewrite. And one of the problems we see is that we have a number of taxpayers who have engaged with this incentive, and this is an incentive. We understand that in 2006 it was introduced specifically on the mandate from government to Treasury and SAR that the amount of innovation in the country needs to be increased. If the innovation increases the direct relationship between innovation, growth, and therefore employment. So companies looked at this and said, okay, we can increase our R&D spend based on the fact that if we look at our costing, we have a little bit of extra money that's being provided by government. They've now embarked upon certain research and development activities, and what is now happening is that legislation is being changed completely so that some of the expenditure going forward will not fall in at all. I think that the problem with this is that it provides a distrust on incentive-type legislation from taxpayers towards the South African Revenue Service and obviously Treasury and therefore government. And there needs to be, if there is an incentive, there needs to be consistency. And obviously the retrospective effect, well, that's completely unacceptable.
2 minutes to go.
2 minutes, that's fine, thank you. If we turn now to the interest, the point I'd like to make there is there are four new sections which are being proposed in the tax laws amendment bill and a change to a fifth one. It's very complex. And what these sections are doing are basically limiting the amount of interest that can be deducted. The first aspect relating to the 23K, which talks about reorganisation transactions, is again the date. On July 2013 is a problem. There are transactions which have been approved by the Revenue Authority as being a transaction that may be entered into and that interest may be deducted, and they haven't yet gone through. And this date will make it problematic for those transactions. They will suddenly be limited, and obviously, again, it creates a lack of trust. The other transactions basically attempt to limit interest on mergers and acquisition type transactions and private equity. Now, I guess the point that needs to be made here is, what are we trying to achieve? What is government trying to achieve? Are we trying to build the country or are we trying to knock it down? Because what we're saying on the one hand is we want to build. On the other, we create a tax law that says, okay, if you are going to invest in our country, we're not going to allow you the tax deduction. I understand perfectly that there is avoidance taking place and that needs to be dealt with. It can be dealt with through mechanisms saying there needs to be tax on the other side. If we look at the base erosion profit shifting
an overseas company, such as a UK holding company. And, you know, a deduction is really not going to help that company, because there's no reason to decide for it. So we just need clarification as to where the deduction should take place, and we would think that it should take place in the company which is the employer, which would be the South African company. The two scenarios which are probably relevant here is where you have an overseas company, and as has already been pointed out, is where you have
storice che mi permette di scrivere che mi ha permesso di scrivere che mi ha permesso di scrivere che mi ha permesso di
interest and foreign Here are all those services, and the parent may have to
Of this is that we've got to have more emphasis
some of these areas. Now, the first one is the simplification and streamlining of the VAT registration process. Now, I can add this is definitely something that needs to be considered for small businesses, and not even just for small, but large businesses as well, are struggling tremendously just to get registered. So we do welcome this attempt to try and assist the businesses to streamline the VAT registration process. We've got a few concerns though, that the limit that we've got, the 1 million rand is compulsory and the 5 million rand for the fast track, or for the traditional VAT registration voluntary limit. There again, you know, we small businesses, will they be able to reach that special million rand? Will you get a contract? Small businesses then will not be compulsory, but then they should be able to enter into the voluntary registration process. So is that 5 million rand not maybe too high for the little guy? We're also not sure how you actually treat the expenses up until you reach the 5 million rand. What happens to that VAT input in that interim? Do you just lose it? Can you claim it back? Because Section 18A adjustment won't be there for certain things like trading stock and trading stock consumables, etc., because you don't have it on hand at the stage that you wish to now make this change in use of judgment. There also the time to change from the fast track system to the traditional system that hasn't been allocated. That again can kill a little bit. If the time period is lagged between the two different processes, you've got your major concerns for the little guys from a cash flow perspective. And again, just looking at the 100,000 rand limit, that just seems a little bit arbitrary, and again, will affect the small businesses from a cash flow perspective. You know, if they're not claimed those input back, especially in the startup phase, it might sink them ultimately. Okay, so what we're basically saying is it's an interim system. I mean, they should be allowed into the system as well, just to try and increase their risk and audit capacity to detect this abuse. And one way of detecting it is required, especially on the income side, it's required that they submit proof of payment. If they submit a proof of payment, then they will be entitled to the input. If we look at other sections that affect small businesses also to an adverse extent is your retirement savings, the deduction that you want to get, 27.5% you claim the tax deductible portion of the contribution. At the moment it's based on the higher of, or proposed to be based on the higher of remuneration and taxable income. Now the taxable income one is the concern for small business owners because you know, they might be in loss position, they might have lower taxable income in a particular year or month, and it varies from month to month, from year to year, and that puts them in again an adverse situation affecting their deductions up and down depending on their taxable income. So I propose they have to base it on income rather than on taxable income for those individuals. If we look at the removal of the dividend character overlap, the owner-managed businesses and the partnerships that do take income out in the form of dividends, there might be a bit of concern there where they will now be classified as gross income. That's actually not true to the intention. So we need to just get an exclusion for those type of owner-managed businesses and professional practices. The anti-hybrid debt instrument recharacterization rules, again, it's fantastic. They've got an exclusion there for all SBCs, small business corporations, but unfortunately not all small businesses fall into that SBC definition. And because of that, for instance, property development companies, rental property owner companies, investment companies, PSPs, they will all be subject to these recharacterization rules, which is definitely not what we want. So again, I think the exclusion should be introduced there that will be linked rather to the size of the business instead of the nature or the activity of the income that that particular business is earning. Right, so that's from a small business perspective, and I think that's definitely something that needs to be considered because it is such an important sector of our economy. We then move on to the next important area that I looked at compared to the National Development Plan, and that's our research and development expenditure. Now, the objective in the NDP is to expand your science, technology, and innovation output, and the way that this is going to be achieved is to increase and encourage research and development. Now, it's against this backdrop that the proposed amendments have been judged. So if we look at the first one, the definition, they can argue for the definition of requirement that must be for sale to or used by the general public. Now again, and also it's going to be globally novel. This is definitely narrowing the definition, and it's a research. So we don't see this as one of the necessary requirements to qualify for R&D. On the pharmaceutical infusions, that's definitely welcome. It's going to definitely assist that particular industry. But the question comes in that we're not quite sure how exactly who and what clinical trials qualify for this. So we need a little bit more guidelines. We said regulations or guidelines should be issued clarifying exactly what would qualify. And also the question can be posed, is why is it not going to be extended to the other industries? Why should we be focusing on the special industry? Should we want South Africa to be recognised in various industries, not just one particular industry? And even the National Development Plan goes further to say that, they give examples of where they've invested public funds into different types of research, such as the space program in the USA, the integrated value chain with the just-in-time manufacturing in Japan, or the high-tech manufacturing industry in Singapore and China, just about anything from China. The R&D behind it and funding from government. So I think broadening that to other sectors, we definitely need to consider that. Then the prototypes, the deduction for that is now being disallowed, thanks to more of a capital nature. But in certain cases, this is a necessity before product can actually be sold. So a deduction should be permitted for this type of expense incurred. And again, bringing this back to the National Development Plan, they're saying that it's essential for South Africa to have an innovative edge and, to continue to contribute to the global scientific and technological advancement of the country. But in order to get this right, we've got to become innovative and we've got to enhance cooperation, both between public sector, science and technology institutions, as well as the private sector. And I think that's critical, is communication between the Department of Science and Technology, SARS, and the taxpayer. To get involved in this research, because it's a really complicated area, it involves a lot of technological insight and knowledge that not all of us have. So communication and as the process goes through, it needs to happen, and hopefully that will continue to happen, start happening a lot more in the future. If we look at the foreign versus local businesses, and that's another area that I've picked up from the National Development Plan, that it says that South Africa must institute aggressive trade and foreign investment policies for a more competitive global path. So we want foreign direct investment because it's key to South Africa's success. But what we're forgetting about here is all about the local companies, about the South African companies. At the moment, we're making it so complex and difficult for them because of exchange controls, uncertain and complex South African legislation, that they're thinking about shifting their profits overseas and setting up treasury companies overseas instead of keeping it in South Africa. And again, it's in this context that I have a look at the legislation. If we look at Section 9D, for instance, we've got certain exemptions, and for the high tax rate for CFCs. And at the moment, it's got a bit of an equitable effect on South African outbound multinationals. For instance, if we take a South African company wanting to start a treasury company off in the UK, their rate is going to be reduced to 20%. They would not qualify for the high tax rate exemption. So our proposal is that we reduce the 75% limit to the 70% limit, because why should you not be able to invest in the UK? There's nothing untoward about the UK. Well, it's also debatable, but compared to some of the other countries that we're looking at. And also, we thought, why don't you introduce horizontal monitoring? And what's the difference between that and vertical monitoring? Well, vertical monitoring, it's working on the pot. So it takes back the first turn based on the pot, which we choose from ourselves and check it. It's retrospective checking, which leads to, in some instances, uncertainty because you don't know what results it's going to come back with. Whereas if we look at the horizontal monitoring, that's based on a mutual trust. And it's understanding and transparency. So you're working side by side along with each other, so there's a willingness from taxpayers to comply, and SARS gives certainty to the position and in a short period of time, which I think is really lacking at this stage from an operational perspective. If we look at the next thing, is the deductible interest limitation. It's again a disincentive for foreign direct investment. And again, we propose to reduce that rate of 25%. Limit, bring that into the rate. And there's a whole technical argument that we've dealt with in the corporate tax commission on that. If we look at the example of international shipping companies, again, it's a fantastic thing for our local companies, trying to incentivize and get that industry up and running again, competitive against international businesses, so it's definitely welcome. But we just want to make sure that it is an effective introduction or proposal, because we're not too sure that there are too many ships, South African registered ships in South Africa. But if there are, fantastic. definitely something that we want to promote and support. Another thing from the Master Feeding Plan for 2013 all the way up to 2018 said that in order to achieve the objectives of the National Development Plan, we've got to reduce the tax compliance costs and the cost of doing business. So this has been a thread going through for quite a while now. And again, it's against this backdrop that I've tried to evaluate some of the amendments coming through to see if they have taken this reduction in compliance costs into account. And unfortunately, there are a few amendments, and I'm not going to go into the details of these that are listed in our various submissions. But these particular amendments are going to result in additional compliance costs, not only for the taxpayer, but also for SOC. And examples of these are the employer verification of the over 65 years of age, the recognition of a DTA relief for withholding tax on services, the goods imported for oil and gas production. Again, these are all welcome. However, you know, the cost involved to comply with this is regarded as mainly too high compared to the benefit that is obtained out of it. The payment recovery of tax, that's the withholding tax on services. Again, you know, we don't have that, the return on exempt dividends. We don't have that for remuneration, we don't have that for interest. Why should we have that for dividends now as well? And the fact of legal notification, again, we're shifting the onus from the taxpayer to submit the legal documents to High Court where SARS chooses instead of a High Court that is near to the taxpayer. So the taxpayer is now going to have to incur additional legal costs to get additional assistance to get the correct jurisdiction in which it has to submit these documents. And this is not mainly full cost that we're talking about. And then there's really been an evaluation of defined benefit plan. Again, we have a complex formula involved here. And surely we can just make payments with the revenue stream. I think this one should be tax administration matters. And again, this isn't, you know, looking at the National Development Plan as such, but also just compared to our constitution. And where's the level playing field in some of these matters that have been dealt with in the Tax Administration Act? If we look at the FAS confidential information disclosure, so FAS doesn't need to provide reasons for assessment of tax calculation if the proposed amendment goes through. So their jurisdiction there has been expanded, and we think this section should be scrapped. If we look at the rules for dispute resolution, which is what the previous section also hampers, they compel you to use e-filing as a delivery mechanism, and in certain cases the section also overrides the primary legislation. We feel that's not possible. So we should be looking at other methods of delivery, not just, especially for the rural areas. We go back to small businesses. You know, they don't all have access. In Polokwane the other day, you know, the Coastal Trust office is 110 kilometres away, and some of them don't even have 3G access at their homes, never mind at their businesses. So that they really are struggling. So making it compulsory for e-filing, I think, is not considering the country in which we are living in. If we look at the understatement penalty, here is open to discretion. So the basis of determination is open to the discretion of a SARS official. And what we're considering here is that perhaps we should be introducing something like a matrix, which the Australian Tax Office has introduced for their revenue officials. So it gives both clarity and guidance for not only the SARS officials to ensure that there's consistency in the treatment, but also for taxpayers to understand how these penalties are going to be levied. What we've also found is SARS is placing the burden of proving an understatement penalty on the taxpayer, where actually the burden should be on SARS, or is on SARS in terms of the Tax Administration Act. And another concern, not keeping off the topic, but criminal offences, you know, what we've seen is that the legislation is trying to draft everything in the form that it's a criminal offence. The fact that you haven't updated your registered particulars requires is now a criminal offence. And although we regard it as if it is an offence, it's something that needs to be done. Making it a criminal offence, I think, is overly harsh, and surely a monetary penalty should suffice to get taxpayers to make sure that they do update their penalties on these matters. So overall, the legislation is welcome, the changes are welcome, the extent of the changes are going to be worth considering, so hopefully that will scale down in the future. But I think all the changes going forward should be looked at, taking the objectives of the National Development Plan and the Stop Fraud
going to present in the public domain. Just to make you aware that the information I'm about to share with you is to obviously discuss issues with the tax or amendment bill, and you shouldn't be using this information to go and bet your pension on the stock market. You can't then blame me for saying this will happen. This is part of the information sharing exercise. This is part of a shell policy. So what I'm going to be talking about is just to give you a little bit of shale gas operation and how we view that to be, to give us stability and clarity in our operations in this country. Raise some of the concerns, as per our submission, and then also suggest some, remedies on how to address those issues. So this is a quick overview of shale gas and what it means, unconventional versus conventional. If you look at this slide, because this underpins, our submission is based on shale gas unconventional operations. So if you look at this slide, you look at the two things on the extreme where the walls are on either side. Those are what is called conventional, oil and gas deposits. So when you drill and explore that, and you obviously need the oil and gas, the gas is under pressure, or the oil, and it gushes out. And normally that occurs in a confined area. So one can contain it quite easily, you can exploit it, explore it, and produce it if it is viable. And most of the activity of oil and gas in the past has been in that area, in that domain. However, increasingly, because of most of the resources from that have been exploited around the world, companies like Shell are actually looking at unconventional shale gas. If you look at the area in the middle, where it's tight gas or shale gas, that generally occurs over a much larger area, where in essence the gas is trapped in the pores of the rock. So, and if I can use an analogy, if you look at the disk, the wood in front of you, that's what it would look like in the ground, obviously a rock. And in that rock there will be gas trapped, which one has to obviously get out. Now, that is the same gas that over time may migrate up towards the oil and gas traps that you see on the extremes. So the shale gas is gas that is trapped in rock formations over quite large distances, and it obviously requires quite vastly different and specialized exploration production techniques. So just to contextualize that in a way. So if one looks at what would happen in this country, given the previous slide that oil and gas operations, especially shale gas, is complex. They're more expensive to bring to production than even mining for, let's say, conventional coal, or even if one looks at the normal mineral sense, mainly because of the way they either where they occur or the way it's trapped in the source rock. The other issue of this is affecting new industry in this country. We are only at the start of what could be a exploration and a production period. We're still in the pre-light, we submit the license obviously, so for South Africa, this will be something totally new and innovative in terms of looking for shale gas in this country. There's no industry established, so it's unproved and we haven't been exported. So in that respect, there's an infrastructure in place to begin. So all those things add to the complexity of an operation of this nature. Given also the way shale gas is found in the ground, they require long exploration periods. Appraisals are high. Now, appraisal is when you drill a well and you find something, you see whether it's economic or not, just to contextualize that. There's long lead times before the cash starts coming in. This is not, this is the nature of it globally. And obviously, in South Africa, we would have to see what happens once we do that, because it could be a different scenario in terms of what the rocks look like and what the area is going to be like. So, based on all those issues, we're therefore believe that given extension of income tax to offshore, we believe onshore should qualify for a similar dispensation, which I will outline in the next few slides. Just a bit of clarity and stability. Obviously, most businesses can operate in various jurisdictions, but the more clear and stable the fiscal and economic regime that government in essence controls, it facilitates what we do. We need clear rules to invest and grow in industry, and a fair return on the investment. Fair return is a return that, in our view, doesn't exploit the people that buy our products. So it must be fair in that respect. I can talk about it more if we have time. And obviously, in our case, particularly critical in terms of the investment that we do to be supportive of the country's socio-economic and also transformation, which is a key issue for this country. Growing the economy enables us to obviously help government addressing our triple challenges, which is poverty, unemployment, and also inequality in our society. And obviously, the plans we will bring with us if we do exploit it will be aligned to that. So we would obviously need the clarity of government to help us exploit this in an optimal manner. So just to come to the clarity that we require, or the concerns that we have in the current TLAB, our main issue is around, and this is based on our interpretation in the current draft bill, that there's not clarity around onshore oil and gas, and the way we get the bill right now looks like it's excluded. And so, we're concerned about that, and I'll come to the next slide on what can be done. So, and that for us is a key issue to be addressed. There are also other issues that we are concerned about, and obviously, you can see the reference of the sections in the bill. The one is around fiscal stability agreement and the fiscal stability rights. In the next slide, I will talk a bit more about it. We've got a concern around where that is defined. We also have a concern around the way exploration is defined, and again, you can see it will be all linked back to the manner in which shale gas operations are being conducted, will be conducted. The current draft, we believe, doesn't take cognizance of this different operation that we will hopefully launch in this country. And of course, the last one is just more comment around the delegation of authorities to the Minister of Mineral Energy, and we're just concerned about how this will work. So if I now go to the next slide and talk in a bit more detail about some of the the actual points that we're raising in our suggested remedies. So if you look at the issue of exclusion of onshore oil and gas, and we say that is based on our interpretation, our remedy is that either the bill be amended to also include onshore oil and gas as part of the definition in that section 165, or one would leave the current draft as it is, because in that way it would mean that oil and gas both on and offshore would be part of that dispensation. But the key thing is we would be clarity whether, and we need to onshore to be included in that definition. The other issue that we just want to raise is
right to act and not to go to the road to act. And again, if you want more detail, I've got some of my colleagues here can provide a bit more depth around that comment. The other issue is, and this is a technical issue, is around the definition of declaration and in reference to the reservoir. And there, you know, a reservoir typically is a confined area or space where you exploit the resource. As I've indicated in my previous in the slide a few minutes ago, but the shale gas, yes, there is a reservoir, but it doesn't occur in a specific location. It's quite a diffuse and sort of a spread over quite a wide area. So we may need to find the word that's not quite as specific as the reservoir. It's just to contextualize, you know, the way a shale gas is distributed in a source rock. And the other point is around the delegation of fiscal stability to the Minister of Mineral Resources, and although we support and agree with that, and this is a comment with Roger provide better administration, I think we probably need to understand better how that would work going forward, because obviously we're not sure how the dispensation would work and how it would be administered. So it's just a comment that we want to bring to the table. That's all. Thank you.
Members, one small question to buy the bullets. First day is a bit. We are almost there. We are now going to call our last presenter. Do you make some calls?
Clearly articulated different categories that will qualify. And so we're suggesting that training be made available as soon as possible for potential drone operators or into the future, to make sure that when we're communicating with investors, we do so with the clarity of knowing who qualifies and who doesn't for incentives. One of the queries that we had was, there was a section that said that 90% of the income of that company must be derived from the business occurring in the zone, and we wondered if this precludes companies who perhaps have interests elsewhere in the country. We understand that you might be able to set up a separate vehicle in which to do this, but again, in the context of needing to minimise red tape, it was one point that we wanted clarity on. Again, the special economic zone will make provision for public-private partnerships as drone operators, and it was just a query as to whether or not the corporate income tax incentive would extend to the zone operator in the context where it is a public-private partnership or perhaps a different type of vehicle. And then we also noticed that biofuels are specifically excluded from the income tax incentive, and the issues of food security are cited as the reasons why. There's obviously varying debate around the impact that biofuels has on food security, and the region surrounding our sites is largely sugarcane, and there's good opportunities for potential ethanol production into the future. So we were just suggesting that maybe that is judged more on a case-by-case basis. Probably our biggest concern, we need I think a little bit of clarity. We understand that the incentive would apply up to 2024 for a period of 10 years. Certainly with our site, a lot of the land that will be developed for industrial purposes still has to go through EIA, planning approval, then you've got to do construction, and then from there, different investors would have to construct buildings. And I assume that it's the same for quite a few of the other zones. And so you're looking at about a five-year lead-in time if you count all the approvals. So what's stated as 10 years really only becomes five. And then, you know, the attractiveness of the zone obviously decreases as one approaches 2023 because it's difficult to give investors any sort of certainty around incentives into the future. And so one of the suggestions we had was that we looked at rewording that to say that the incentive applies 10 years post-establishment of the investor within the zone. And then also just another point of clarity, maybe to bring to your attention, we have a trade zone area that is currently up and running. We have some investors who are already located within that zone. Should we demarcate the zone, we just need to understand whether or not the incentive would apply to investors who are already established within the zone area. Thank you.
Thank you very much, to the delight of everyone. Members, we are going to break, and thereafter we will continue our discussions. Let's observe our break, and the time now is let's take it for a possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you think that's possible? Do you think it's possible to get supplies from outside South Africa on cyberspace? Is it workable? And secondly, why do you not then support no vehicles whatsoever? And then on the heart of the economic growth is to have a healthy small business industry. You know, if we don't grasp that, we will never see economic growth in this country. Your feeling, the VAT proposals as proposed, is really happening there. You think it's good or bad for us? And then Shell, I'm not in favor of fracking, so I have to disclose my interest. So I want to know, what's the difference? Should we not delete offshore in a tension? You know, why? Would it make a difference if we take out offshore exploration and completely treat it like onshore exploration? You know, would it make a difference to you, or will it be more beneficial for you to take it onto the tension? I don't know what this proposal is going to do to the environment. I don't know whether the Treasury will consult with the Department of Environment with regard to this. Will it have an impact if you are getting onto the 10th schedule? I just want to know that. And then, what is the meaning of fiscal stability? I just want to know what is your definition of fiscal stability? I'm very uncomfortable to give it away to the Department of Mining. But I first want to know what's the meaning of fiscal stability. Maybe Tracy can tell us that, but I don't know why they want to give that away. So what does it mean? Are you comfortable, or do you want it either Tracy to have that definition and make that decision, or do you want mining more because they profit more on the side of your business?
I was just discussing with some of my colleagues about the fact that we do seem to have a lot more interest in the tax bill this year than in previous years. And if you just observe these proceedings, it would seem that there's a much broader range of issues that the presenters are taking up, which perhaps raises the question that we discussed yesterday around whether maybe some of these provisions were rushed, maybe there were mistakes that have crept in or issues of unintended consequences. And I think that raises the first point that Saika put forward. I'm sorry I missed that point in the presentation, but talking about the vacancy rate in Treasury, and it wouldn't be hard to draw a line between the huge amount of attention we have on the tax bill this year and a potential capacity problem in Treasury for SARS. Now, I know Saika at one stage has deployed people to the Trade and Industry Department in the CIPC. I mean, in Saika's opinion, is this something that could be replicated in National Treasury and SARS? If I'm correct about this vacancy situation, would Saika be prepared to step in? Secondly, the point about all of the presenters, actually, many of them spoke about that, and my sense of it is that we have a choice when it comes to that. We can either tighten up the conditions around that, which clearly SARS has done, or the other way you can do it is you can boost monitoring and enforcement of SARS. And my concern is that we're putting far too much emphasis on the former and not enough on the latter, which again I think speaks to the capacity issue. So the problem is then the cost is borne by really mostly small businesses in this country, as opposed to make up for an apparent capacity problem at SARS. I don't know if any of the presenters agree with me on that and would like to perhaps propose solutions in that regard. Then on allow assessments beyond the 3-year period. Now, when they presented that to us, the committee, I said, look, I'm sure you would want an indefinite period, so I would love to be able to go back to any point to do assessment. But clearly, there's a public interest that needs to be taken into account here. And my view is that we need to balance SARS' ability to go back in time and do assessments with the public interest that at some point you need to be able to move on and leave your taxpayer to pay all of them. I'm interested that nobody presented on that. What is the view of all of our presenters on that? Is it reasonable what they're proposing in Clause 34? Then, Chair, many of the presenters spoke about this employee shares. And employee share schemes. I understand Treasury's proposed the amendments because they're concerned about high income earners using equity shares as a form of disguised salary. To what extent did that happen? I mean, in the experience of our presenters, do they think Treasury wanted something there? Is the system misused? And if so, is what they propose not required? So that's my first question. But Chair, my real frustration here is that in a country where we're trying to align the interests of ordinary South African workers with the interests of the people that own the means of production, I think we're not generous enough when it comes to using employee share schemes. I mean, I'd be interested if EY or any of the other presenters would support really bold uses of tax incentives to promote employee share ownership schemes. What if the percentage of the value of the shares given to employees in a genuine employee share scheme could be tax deductible? I know it would cost the state, but surely that would really promote this kind of approach to capitalism that I think we need in this country. The other question for EY was these treasury management companies. I'm a little bit confused. You're not allowed to transact in any currency. Surely once you're transacting in another currency, then forex laws don't apply by definition. Are you saying that you can do transactions in another currency and then we extend our exchange control regulations to cover those transactions? It's a little bit confusing. I'm interested in what still applies once you can transact in another currency. To Institute of Tax Practitioners. The big topic in this forum last year, Chair, was the fact that we were now requiring them to join controlling bodies. And I believe last year we heard that only 50% of them were registered. I wonder if we can get a report back on how that's gone. Are we happy that it all happened? Did we pass a good law last year? And then Shell. I myself got some clarity on the 10th schedule during the break, but I think it might be useful for the committee to hear the history of why we have this. I also echo my colleague's question around fiscal stability. I understand the 10th schedule is a very, or at least a generous set of tax breaks. Is fiscal stability a euphemism for those tax breaks, or is it another concept entirely? And I understand the logic behind the original set of tax breaks was to encourage the sector to boost energy independence, that kind of thing. Surely, if that logic applies to offshore gas, and I understand in this in the current tax proposals they actually made more generous in terms of dividends tax, then it must apply to onshore. If we still want to promote the sector, it should be neutral whether it's offshore or onshore gas. On duvet trade courts, I mean, I sympathise with the position that we're a bit stuck on this committee because the administration of SEZ is up to trade and industry, and they passed the bill yesterday, actually. So my feeling is that the tax incentives are good and strong, but if you're wrapped up in red tape trying to establish the SEZ, then you might not get those tax benefits anyway. So we're our hands are a bit tighter. Your one question about 90% of income having to come from the SEZ, interested in if you think that might just be a simple way around that pavilion, if you'd see a scenario where many companies wouldn't do that for some reason, and therefore be prejudiced. Thank you.
Thank
you. So thank you very much to the presenters for coming, especially when we got the web and came to which we all sat in the chat room. And secondly, I'd like to apologize to the chair for coming late just because of the rain. Chair, my first clarity will go to Mark and Senyang. You spoke about the shift scheme anomalies. And if you remember, I think you said repeat because I just did not understand. Now, what is being proposed by the department? I hear you quite well. But what I don't understand is what you are trying to advise us that we need to look at it. And I need to get that one to sink in my mind. You are saying deductions for JSE listed companies meaningless. It is meaningless, is what you're saying. And they're also saying the foreign companies are not taxable. And they're also saying employers should qualify for deduction. Just made that. And let me just get a clear picture. Exactly what do you want to say here? Where do you want to arrive at? Secondly, still on the SNN, on the R&D, research and development, where you say medicines are in the R&D intervention, and as such, incentives should be specifically included in this course. Now, practically, if I'm not looking at medicine as maybe the Nurofen suspension, I am looking at medicine as taking a group of people with a particular diagnosis and they actually make trials on them before they arrive at the diagnosis and the proper treatment and the proper medicine and the strength. This is my understanding. But what you are saying here, then it makes my understanding of why the department has to refine that part of the R&D. It makes me confused. So I just need your consent because you're saying a very important issue, but I'm not getting it. Coming to the shop, I didn't ask to understand far better the content of the term schedule because I just wanted to understand exactly what you are proposing, whether it is feasible or not. Like Honorable Nick Koronoff, what do you mean by fiscal stability and fiscal rights? That needs to be also included in the term schedule because if I get it from the department, the term schedule was the provision given as a relief. Right? And you are proposing that we need to include the offshore. You are saying there is no reference to the offshore on the term schedule. This is what you're saying. Okay. If then that's not what you are saying, then it means I didn't hear it as well. But all what I want to know is that if you are saying let us try and assist and make sure that Mr. Sachin is in the revenue, what do you think then on exploration of the definition and the sustainable, all the definitions they're referring to? We need to assist you. Now, my concern is, seemingly, we haven't engaged quite well with the National Treasury on this issue. Because as you go along, you can pick up that you still need an engagement yourself and the National Treasury for us to be able at the end of the day and say, this is what Sherry is saying regarding the inclusion of this definition to the term schedule. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Jen. My question is directed to Mark and Sharon, and it's with regards to the 23N and 23P. And thank you for the focus that you've put onto the requirements of the National Development Plan. But I find that requirements is that the following are investments. And then, do you consider if this schedule still excludes onshore, don't you think it's unconstitutional to have the right to do this and to do the research and do the exploration at this point in time? And then just a practical question. Is the moratorium still in place at this point in time in regards to exploration? What is the current status and what progress do you see in this regard? And perhaps the progress made in terms of the integrated resource plan, there's a bit of difficulty identifying the energy mixes for the future and how do you see you fit into the integrated resource plan and what would your proposals be? And is that not the prerequisite? First, we get the integrated resource plan in place before you can carry on, because we need to know exactly what sources will be allocated for 2030 and what progress has been made in terms of your presentation to the Department of Energy.
You cited on page 3 that when some demand the information of the bodies that you share information and that creates a problem. Why also you stated that you probably do have the data either for people outside the country or within. So why do you think that information must not be handed over to such entities? What are the problems that you are foreseeing on that, because you do share information in there? And secondly, on page 4 as well, on the VAT registration, whose fault is it when that taxable, in insufficient level of taxable is applied? Is it the fault on the fault on SAT, or is also a fault because you are still there also demanding that there must be a check, getting interest back when that money is being repaid back? How would that be avoided? Going to site, I've got this problem as well. Can you explain to us what exactly are these criminal offences when you talk about tax administration matters? I understood the above, the understatement penalties, but where are declared issues under criminal offences? Can you cite some few examples of those issues that you feel that SARS is over harsh in raising those issues? Then the last one, may I also get a bit explanation or clarity under section 165.1 H and I? What are the unforeseen challenges under that Act? You cited that there are a number of challenges there which appear
buying more shares in terms of the shares.
Oh, okay. Basically, then we're sending back into sort of the AT provision. And the type of share that this will arise on, this dividend deduction stroke taxability, is ones that are restricted. So the minute that they become unrestricted, then these provisions won't apply. And then if they reinvest them back into shares, then at the point that those shares become unrestricted, then they will be taxed on them as normal remuneration. Another question that came from Honourable Harris was also in relation to share schemes. Is the system misused? Is this change not required? And I think that I raised the point, and so did Sharon from the site, that if one looks at tax rates and the actual amount of tax that is the differential, there's not really a lot of incentive to abuse per se. I mean, if somebody holds a share and a company has 15 million shares and there's only 10% of those shares that are held by the employees, and those shares are given to those employees for the purposes of retention or for a broad-based scheme, then the dividend will be declared to all the shareholders, and they just happen to be some of the shareholders that are given dividends. So under normal circumstances, I don't think the abuse is very broad. I think there are a lot of share incentive schemes. That is a fact. And dividends are paid in respect of those shares. And this change is going to have a significant effect on that. I'm kind of assuming Mr. Watson, but since I'm on share schemes, maybe that you can also answer. But the point here is, and this is for Honourable Scott Sana, the point is that what is currently the situation is that if a share is given to an individual, that share is ultimately taxed, who's an employee, is ultimately taxed, the value of that share is ultimately taxed in that individual's hands for tax purposes, so fully like remuneration. What happens during the period of that holding until it becomes unrestricted is that dividends are declared, and at the moment those dividends are received in the employee's hands as a normal dividend. In other words, withholding tax will have been withheld and there will be no further tax in the employee's hands. What is being proposed is that that dividend will be taxed in full as well, but that the company will be allowed to deduct, just like remuneration. The problem that we all have is that the company that's paying the dividend isn't necessarily the company that is employing directly the employee. So what the legislation is doing is allowing a deduction to a company that can't make use of it. So the problem with this is that you've got full tax in the employee's hands and no deduction.
At a point of clarity. If this is what Deborah is saying, what if the holding company is getting an income?
Then it may be permitted to have a deduction, but generally these holding companies are literally holding companies, and all they do is receive dividends because they hold the shares of the group. And the same applies for the foreign companies as well. If it's a foreign company that's declaring the dividend, there is no deduction. The foreign company doesn't have any tax problem in South Africa, so it doesn't have any deduction. So that's another aspect that we're pointing out, that there's a mismatch, and that needs to be looked at by the drafters. Does that help?
No, and of course, it has. And there would be a session more follow-up if your questions were not clear on this one.
Jason, thank you. I'll take the... I think we're not anything for me to get to Alice's question about the vacancy at Treasury. We picked up on an article and saw that we understand that at the moment there are 13 vacancies in the position of where they're drafting the law. And our concern is that it would put pressure and could maybe lead to oversight or error in that department, and we, that's why we raise the concern, and we're hoping that the minister would address this and make sure that they strengthen up the capacity of that department to get the law properly written. So yeah, we just believe that it's putting really serious pressure on the staff of the department.
funds and fraud by your current audit processes. And talking about, still on the land side, the global best practice, maybe I must just start by explaining what the difference is between business to business and business to customer. When we talk the Amazon and compare the Amazon and the Kalahari South African business, the foreign one, if you buy an e-book or something from the foreign supplier, the onus is on me as customer to pay over that source, because they don't have a presence, they're not registered in South Africa. If I buy from Kalahari, they will charge a VAT on that book. Now, at the moment, the OECD is looking at dealing with e-commerce. There's a whole report that we understand will be released towards the end of the year, and that would establish what we think would be global best practice of dealing with that. If a business imports a book, if they buy it from a local supplier, they claim the VAT input as a tax deduction, so there's no loss to the first business in the net. If it's a consumer, then there's been losses. And internationally, the global best practice we believe will come from the OECD model, where they will bring out a report and say this is what they advise countries to adopt, and this is what our proposal really talks to. Then, on the controlling bodies and registration, I'll talk about Section 34. Maybe we should just take it chronologically. Clause 34 in the bill that deals with the amendment to Section 99. The principle at tax law at the moment still is, and that has been confirmed by the Supreme Court as well, that we need finality. We need to be able to get assessments finalised and have no disputes. This is going to be 3 years for most assessments. But when an error is made, and maybe you haven't seen that, the Act must allow SARS to amend assessments as well. So in this instance, where there's a correction of an error, and maybe SARS picks it up, it allows for them to correct that error as long as the request is made within that period. And maybe one should comment on that, you know, why limited to the 3 years, but I think in the context of what we have currently, the law is, and the Supreme Court of Appeal agree with that you must have some money, that you cannot ever have SARS come back and say that we still want to amend your assessment. Similarly, the taxpayer must not be in a position to come back after 3 years and say, please change that assessment there. If I don't know if you want to add something to that. Okay. Then on the controlling bodies, when we met with SARS, and maybe the chairman from SARS can confirm, I think we were sitting at 13,000. Professionals that had registered with SARS. There was a slow take up. On the 1st of July, it was less than 7,000 of people that had registered. We believe that the intent is good. We support that. We believe that it would lead to better tax related work rendered to taxpayers. So taxpayers overall would benefit from this. We did raise a concern last year that there were people in the field that were probably competent tax advisors but are now excluded because they cannot belong to the professional body. We've seen some of that. We've had all the bodies, I'm sure, we certainly had requests of people hiding us and saying, can we belong to you? We can't do tax anymore. So yes, I think from that point of view, the intent is good and the legislation is good and it's been applied. It's too early to say. We've only been in 1 month, we haven't actually exchanged any information, we've had no reports or disciplinary reports given to the body, so we haven't tested the system in that sense. People have just merely come on board so far. Sharing information, that's the last job. What we found, and this is why we raised that concern as well, SARS is very protective of the information of taxpayers, and rightly so. They will not make any private information available to any person of any person's tax affairs yet. Now, their concern is, now we need to, an exchange of information relates to this person is a member of our body, this person meets certain continued professional education requirements, needs certain qualifications, etc. And we need to communicate that with them and say that person is a member of our body. We're finding it problematic, and as I said, maybe our institute is unique, and Shannon can maybe deal with this Southern Institute of Tax Practitioners with experience. But we've only got, we believe, about 7,000 other members that are specifically required to be registered as tax practitioners. If a SAICA member is a financial director of a company and submits tax returns there, then you don't have to be registered because you do that in your employment engagement. So it's problematic for us to just give them 35,000 members information. We really want to have this scenario where they're coming back to us and say, confirm that this member is a tax practitioner, confirm that this member is, well, this member that is registered as tax practitioner is a member of your body, confirm that they meet the required CPD requirements, etc. So this is what we're asking, to just make it easier to exchange information between the two of us. So that we principally saying, SARS would be able to give us information as well. We are under an obligation to always provide SARS with information that they require within what they, the ambit of what they have to administer. Oh, the stop, yes. Thank you, thanks for reminding me. The was raised, yes, SAICA did help out at CIPC, at the company's office, where there was a problem there. I think tax legislation is difficult, and why, you know, but we may have the risk here that if I said DEFRA, that she would influence Section 8C legislation. Now, we, you know, I think there's a bit of a problem that I would believe that the requirement there is to have a continuous, or a body of employees here that are really consistent dealing with the legislation, understand the policy, be able to legislate in there and get that right. And that maybe a short-term giving of staff or additional assistance may not be the appropriate way to go about that. I believe that it is a matter that you should have a long-term competent, they are competent, the people that are there, but a long-term person that's developed in writing the law. I think it's not easy, our tax legislation is not easy, and then that takes it. But certainly, you know, I would imagine as a professional body, and I would imagine we would be as a professional body, we would be willing, and that's why we assist in making comments here, to engage people there, but I think it may be problematic, because you want to have a longer-term engagement there.
He laughed when he said Deborah might influence, but even though I might be entirely objective in assisting SARS, there has been a situation already in the UK where there were staff from the various firms seconded into the Revenue Authority to assist with drafting legislation under the total control of the Revenue Authority, and that came out into the press, and that was exactly what was the accusation. So it is actually a very difficult situation to do with the Revenue Authority because of the it's a fine balance between
it's horrific. The amount of time and money that the small businesses, and it's not even limited to small at the moment, are having to spend to try and get that registration through to get an actual VAT number. And if you don't get it, you've got penalties and interest levied on that, you've got to object, and that also costs money and time. So anything, and specifically fast track, is really an attractive option for small businesses. So that's great. So the only problem with that is, as long as they can explain how you move out from the fast track to the traditional, and again from an operations perspective, if all the things flow through here, this is a horse, then get your number and start claiming, not a problem. On the other side, the compulsory, like I said, the R1 million is not going to assist small businesses because it's difficult to get those contracts. Same with R5 million, you are compulsory, put it that way, you're then left with the voluntary. The fast track works, it's awesome, we just need to know exactly what the procedures are, the time period, and the process to change from one system to the next. The R5 million idea is definitely too high for small businesses. There's no way that they would be able to qualify for that, because to secure a contract with a total spend of R5 million without a VAT registration number, it's just not going to happen. So that, I think, is not a valid option for small businesses. Look, all of this, I think, ultimately will be done away with when we get the typical registration process going. I'm not too sure when that is going to come through. So I think this is a temporary measure, and if the fast track works, you know, I think it's a great one for small businesses. Regarding the question of Clause 34 with the 3-year assessment period, again, our submission on that particularly was that as long as Clause is required to prove that the taxpayer has employed a lazy tactic, then it's not too much of a problem. And in instances where the taxpayer is not intentionally drawing out the 3-year period, taxpayers should be provided with the opportunity to decide whether or not they'd like the period to be extended. Alternatively, we've said the objective circumstances in which Charles may extend the period should be clarified, and that should be clarified up front. Also, the scope of the section should be limited to whatever is reflected in specific documents, and the employer should not be able to open up anything else that they find in that extended period of time. So it should be limited to that, and also the position should be subject to objection and appeal. Regarding the registration of tax practitioners, it's been a busy few months. We've got over 10,000 members joining with us at the moment. It was a rush to the law at the end, as everyone knew, so it was a bit hectic. But I think it's been a fantastic process. It was definitely needed. We've just done a roadshow to all our members currently across the country, and I can see that there is, you know, it's instilled in them something that they realise that they have to do things properly now. And I think, you know, there was a reason why the regulation was there, and I think it's fulfilling its purpose. So ultimately, the guys are realising that there's a lot of risk involved in this doing it. But I think really the people outside will now not impose problems on those that are actually proper tax practitioners, which I think was a concern for a lot of them. And the only concern that we picked up is that they say all the risk is now on them, but there's no reciprocal risk or no reciprocal service fees, etc., on the SARS side. So we are required to have tax certificates. We require all of those things. But what about the SARS officials that they're dealing with? Why are they not required to have tax certificates, CPD requirements? And that's something that we deal with our members with that. Why is it only on one side? If we look at the question regarding Section 23N, our proposal is basically with the 75, bringing in that 75 limit there as well. And is that sufficient? To be honest, I'm not too sure. We said, limited interest limitation only if it's the ultimate recipient pays the tax at a rate lower than 75% of the South African tax rate. And we also said the proposed withholding tax and interest should also cater for this particular problem as well. But further than that, I'm not sure if it is going to be enough, to be honest. With the ongoing communication, what I mean is, we do be having fantastic meetings with Treasury and international and operational stakeholders meetings. I clearly see a change or shift in the way that they've been treating us and engaging with us since the regulation of tax practitioners. I think they are taking us seriously. And the open communication, the Treasury meetings that we've been having, is really informative. It assists us in knowing what they do, and they also understand our problems. And I think that is critical going forward. For me, any change, and that's why I say not even on the legislative side, which is fantastic, but also on the operational side, which we've got them doing as well, from our PM side, and that is to pick up major problems, add to their attention, and let them filter it down to us as soon as it occurs, instead of waiting, sending government body, we can send it out to all our members immediately. So if bank registration changes, for instance, new documentation required, it gets to head office. Then on that same day, we send it out to members. If somebody travelling from Kimberley to Bloemfontein to do a bank registration, knows before he leaves what he actually needs, instead of landing up at the office and then having to travel back to Kimberley to get the information. So I think that's definitely a positive shift that I've seen, with the communication between us, regulated controlling bodies, and staff, and it definitely builds bridges across the obstacles that we're facing, both on a legislative and operational side. So that's good. Getting to the criminal offences, not in section 234, and basically I'm going to list a few of them, and for instance the one that I mentioned is where a taxpayer fails to neglect or to register or notify staff of change in the register particulars. I do understand that's important, especially if you know how to deliver notices, etc. But making it a criminal offence, I think, is maybe overly harsh, whereas a penalty, I think, would suffice. If you make it a heavy penalty, the guy's not going to do it again. Other things that are included in there are if you fail or neglect to appoint a representative taxpayer or notify staff of the appointment or change of a representative taxpayer, fail or neglect to register the tax practitioner, fail to submit a return or document to staff or issue a document to a person as required under the Act, or to retain records as required by staff, issue a false certificate or statement, and issues were raised, and so you carry on. So some of these, I think, are definitely serious, but making it a criminal offence, I think that's maybe a little bit too harsh.
Thank you very much. Let's move to Shannon.
Thank you, Chair. I'll go through these questions very quickly, but just to say that there's been quite a few references made to the 10th schedule and detail around it. I'll leave it to my colleagues, Steve Knowles, to take this through after I've briefed you on some of the issues that you raised. Honourable Kuranov, just to the point you raised about where should responsibility rest, is it Minerals or is it Treasury? I think, Treasury has got the expertise that is there, to their domain, so there's no doubt about that. I think the point that we have made there, there was a internal memorandum attached to this bill where it said that the fiscal ability might practically be delegated to the mineral resources. But if it is around administration of the licensing, and what we think it means is that once they issue a license to an applicant, it may come with a fiscal ability degree that qualifies, but that agreement still is subject to approval by National Treasury. So I don't think there's any doubt about it. It should stay with you, because that is where the expertise lies regarding it. And you raised obviously quite a critical question on the environment in terms of what we want to do with our operations now. So I think it's fundamental. I mean, it's critical. And I suppose it's around the debate of development versus environment now. And so we don't think it's an either-or situation. We think both can exist. I mean, it is, and obviously it's within reason. You can't have development that impacts the environment in a negative way. I think the potential of the shale gas and crew is of such, potential that I think we should at least look at it, exploit it. And if it's economically viable, and you can exploit it in such a way that the environment is impacted, is managed within our country's regulations and laws, then one should look at it now. We have, as a company, I know, have some best practice operating principles that we have been shared with people. And those principles, based on our experience worldwide, we have principles in place that make sure that minimal and no harm to people, fauna, flora, the environment we operate. And also we've within the group we've made commitments that we would not compete with, for instance, water with people in the group, because we believe that is, we shouldn't do that. But in addition, we understand there is a government that's currently drafting regulations. And that will obviously be, there for the various processes. And I think, the key department there is obviously water and environment, because that is fundamental, they should own it. And mineral resources will obviously administer the regulations around mineral exploitation. And be comfortable and feel confident that process, will enable, if feasible, operations to take place. But obviously, stability in the agreement. I think it was instituted to provide fiscal stability, to encourage oil and gas exploration. And some countries in the world have done that. We are aware of countries like where they've got similar systems in place, Algeria, Argentina, China, and the UK, where, you know, their version of treasury has instituted systems in place with similar interest because it's new, and obviously it's, you know, it could be taken away if it's exploited properly. I do agree with the question about engagement with treasury. We've only started engagement process recently when we submitted our comments, but they are requesting more engagement going forward because we do believe some of the issues that we raised, you know, once we talked to them, it can be resolved and we can obviously come to some understanding on those issues. So we've started the process of those people take it forward then, engaging me. Honourable Ross, yeah, I think you raised some questions, quite a few. Let me just quickly tell. On the moratorium, yeah, the moratorium was obviously lifted in September last year, but there were some conditions attached to it. And the conditions were that if anybody gets the declaration rights agreement, they could only proceed under normal circumstances, i.e. not allowing any hydraulic fracturing. And the conditions are that for that to happen, the minister has to put in place regulations which are currently visible now, so they can only have to pass the group by all stakeholders. And also they have two other things, a monitoring committee needs to monitor, this is a broad monitoring committee that will monitor activities in that area, consisting of government stakeholders, community, scientists, etc., to monitor activities in that area. So ladies and gentlemen, although it's been lifted, nothing has happened. You also raised the question of whether, so we have got a license to explore the hit, and that is believed as part of the ongoing process that we, you know, would respect government's decisions, and we'll wait until we are ready for the proper process. You also raised the question about the importance of the IRP. Yes, it's fundamental because the resource plan that's coming from the Department of Energy will obviously look at a new mix of energy. Currently, it's dominated by coal because coal is our most, you know, it's in situ, we should utilize it more. But the problem with coal is it's going to be, you know, it's got quite a restrictive or quite a, I would say, bad, but it's, yeah, it's a bad CO2 footprint. So we're quite keen to exploit gas. Gas provides 50% less CO2 output than coal, for instance. But we need to be sensitive that it is a local, you know, coal is locally utilized. Obviously, it must be a clean coal, it does work. But I want to make the point that in order to develop our country going forward, we need all the energy sources we can get. Gas is going to play a bigger role. Solar is going to be critical with the new, you know, renewable, and that's really going to be a big plus. Coal will still play a dominant role, it will still dominate. And of course, there's other nuclear, depending on how things go. We know that there's no silver bullet, it's all of them to make the economy work. The nice thing about gas, though, is that it's big. I mean, I'll give you an example. To bring, if we have to import gas tomorrow, within 18 months, you can have a plant that's up and running. 18 months. That's sort of the time frame that it will be a cheaper to operate, but obviously, you know, there's ERA sort of needs to be done, but that sort of gives us that flexibility. And obviously, it can be used on, unlike coal power, in the past, we talked about coal power station. And we believe that this system, there's a process underway currently, what it means is a bit more detail around how it operates.
Provisions specific to the hosting oil and gas industry, and I
be derived by the company operating in the special economic zone. Understand that one could put in place a vehicle in which to do that, and I don't think there's any other way really to control that and to make sure that the incentive is dealt with in administratively the easiest way possible and also not abused. I guess the concern from our side is to make sure that the one-stop shop, as in position of the SEZ bill, is functioning well and that there's minimum turnaround times agreed to by all stakeholders in terms of approving applications for foreign investors and any other relevant applications that might be submitted. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The draft are here, and we hope that at an appropriate time they will be able to feedback on all issues that have been raised by presenters. That started from social, I don't know, it's not your chair, it's our chair, where we are interrogating stakeholders. Your chair is coming, but I can see your system. I'm not sure what is it that you think you might do to entail now. Can you please come in and let us know what is it that you're insisting to say to this meeting?
Thank you, Jane. Thanks. I'll be very short. I just wanted to put into context the discussion that was made about the vacancies in Treasury. I'm not too sure where the figure comes from. It's definitely not a figure that Treasury is aware of, that there is such a high vacancy rate. As a matter of fact, I think we've got a relatively good complement of staff. The other issue that I have to make is that the drafting of all the tax legislation is a joint effort between SARS and Treasury. And you see the expertise sitting here that are involved in that particular process. Not all of them, but all the people here from Kerry to this people here are involved in it, as a few hours back. So there's a good pool of people between SARS and Treasury that are involved, and I can give you that assurance. Obviously, you will find that staff turn over from time to time. That's normal in any organization. But I think my colleagues from SARS will confirm that the concerns is a bit overstated. Thank you, Jane.
Members and our presenter, I'm not going to comment on what you have just said about the rest of the matter.
we are all one family in this financial sector. Thank you very much, and thank you for this.